LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and my guest today is John Michael Greer, who joins us to discuss his book, The Occult Philosophy Workbook, a one-year course in the secret wisdom. With origins in the most ancient of times, occultism concerns the unseen world and the hidden planes of being. Beyond the limits of time and space and the dogmas of science and religion, reality is more complex than we can possibly imagine. Although occultism has much to offer both science and religion, once we learn to look beneath the surface, consisting as all things do of one cosmic root substance, humans are spirit and matter balanced, and we are now at a critical point in our evolutionary process. A process as vast as the cosmos, itself arisen from a single source. A process which points to the mystery and origin of life, to the meaning and purpose of existence. For those that have eyes, the secret wisdom may show what modern society has taught us not to see. And far from being mere esoteric abstractions, these insights may yet make the difference between transcendence and oblivion. Hello and welcome, John, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, thank you for having me back on.
Today, John, we're going to be talking about one of your recent books. You've got a number coming out at the moment, but the one we're talking about today is The Occult Philosophy Workbook, a one-year course in the secret wisdom. Before we get started, just for listeners who don't know, give them a quick rundown on your background and your work in general.
These days it's starting to get a little busy. I got involved in the study of occultism back in my teen years. This was the 1970s, the beginning of the late 20th century occult revival. Worked within the Golden Dawn tradition for many years, ended up taking a jaunt into Druidry, not something I'd really ever expected to do. But I ended up spending 12 years as the head of an American Druid, or Grand Archdruid was my official title. I write a lot of books. I write a weekly blog. I appear on a certain number of podcasts. In terms of the background of this book, again, I've been a student of occultism for many years, and it just occurred to me that it was past time that somebody had done a modern, updated account of classic occult philosophy that was fairly user-friendly and that people could get into.
Yeah, I think the key there is user-friendly, and this is something that we may come back to in our discussion. Mm-hmm. Now, the clue is in the name, subtitle of your book, A One-Year Course in the Secret Wisdom. What I did in advance of our talk today, of course, I read the whole thing from cover to cover in a couple of days, which is not really how it's intended to be. But I did that for the purpose of our talk. So perhaps we should just say, for a lot of people, the word occult in of itself is problematic because, they what does that mean? So who is this book for? Because off the top of my head, I would say, well, it's for everybody on the planet,
But a lot of people don't see it that way. The word occult, there's a lot of confusion around it. It simply means hidden or difficult to see or obscured. There's some history behind that. Back in the Renaissance, when occultism was revived after the long period of medieval theological suppression, The standard way to talk about the old classical mystical teachings that fed into occultism was to speak of them as occulta philosophia, the occult philosophy, the hidden philosophy. That gradually morphed into occultism, the way that we went from submarine boat to submarine. English is like that. We like taking adjectives and turning them into nouns. But occultism is the study of the unseen. It's the study of the aspects of the universe that human beings don't easily perceive without a little bit of training. And so, to some extent, this book is written for anybody who's curious about that. Of course, there are many different versions as to many different accounts, many different stories as to what the unseen is. We have our scientific materialists who are insisting there is nothing. It's matter and energy, and that's it. Not that they've ever proved that. It's their act of faith. We have a lot of religious traditions that say, you know, here is our holy book. Here is our theology. Here are our belief systems. This is the truth, and don't you dare ask any questions. The basic idea of occultism ever since its origins in ancient times is, no, let's find out. Let's take a look for ourselves. Let's learn to experience these things. Let's learn how we can, you know, open the doors of perception a little wider and get a clearer idea of what the unseen dimensions of this universe we live in, what they're actually like. That's been in process for a very long time. We now have a lot of different ways to develop those expanded perceptions. And a lot of what I've written over the years has been discussions of ways of, you know, manuals of training, basically, so that people who are interested in doing this can get some idea of how to do it, how to go about that. But there's also a point to looking through what has been previously learned, what previous students of the occult, of the unseen, have understood about the world. And that's generally lumped together in under the label occult philosophy. That's what this book is about.
I wonder how, when I was growing up then, that what was fed down to me from the adults was that the occult or occultism was wholly negative. I wonder where that came from.
Well, partly it comes from Christianity. No. The Christian religion has had they've had a frankly paranoid attitude toward occultism since very early on, and there are reasons for that, because the occult traditions that have come down to us were originally pagan. They were evolved in they originated in Egypt. They were passed on to Greek society in the time of Pythagoras and some of the people who came after him. They became a living tradition within Greek-speaking society all over the Eastern Mediterranean, passed on to Rome, you know, all the usual stuff in ancient history. But so they were part of the pagan worldview that Christianity wanted to eliminate. And they were a tempting part of that worldview. They were part of that worldview that people were interested in, because a lot of people, you know, they pick up very quickly on the idea that the guy in the funny collar who is telling you this is true and you had better believe it or God will beat you up forever, that maybe he might have a vested interest in saying certain things, and maybe he might be looking for the advantage, his own advantage, and that of the organization he represents. So a lot of people are going, okay, well, I want to find this out. I want to check for myself. I want to figure out how I can expand those windows of perception. And of course, for a good many centuries, people who tried to do that and got caught got burned at the stake. So there's a lot of paranoia within Christianity about occultism. There's a lot of dread, a lot of, you know, if people do this, they'll find out that they'll end up coming to conclusions that are not part of our teachings. And then they'll fry in hell for, you know, they'll be beaten up by God for all eternity. And then you have the flip side of that from the scientific materialists, who are all saying, you know, there is nothing but matter, but dead matter and dead energy and void. And if you perceive anything else, you're wrong. It's just as dogmatic as the Christians, frankly. And, you know, not one. But again, there's that very negative response.
But Christianity is very mysterious. I mean,
of course it is.
Yeah, and it's full of the unknown, you know. And
of course. But the problems for the last 2,000 years, and it's not just Christianity. I have to say, it is not just Christianity. There have been a number of religions. We can call them prophetic religions or revealed religions. They're not the religions that grew up naturally in a society. There was a prophet, or there was a messiah, or there was a holy man who said, this is the truth, and you have to believe it, or God will beat you up forever. And that was very fashionable for a while in a large part of the world. You had these religious reformers who were convinced they knew the truth, and who took some particular set of ideas, some set of opinions about reality, and said, this is the truth and you must believe it or, you know, the usual threats apply. And I think we're still getting over that. I think we're still getting back to the point where we can look at the unseen. We can look at the very complex, very mysterious universe that we live in and say, no, it's okay to explore. It's okay to ask questions. It's okay to develop your own capacities to perceive so you can find out for yourself. Because for a long time, that was not okay. And as I say, I think we're still getting over that.
I think it's, I might be paraphrasing you here from the book, but something along the lines of occultism has a lot to offer that science, mm-hmm. religion. I mean, science, religion, philosophy, just different ways of achieving knowledge, really.
No, and one of the points that I make in the book, and it's a very important point, is that science and occultism and religion are actually looking at different things. Science is the study of the material world, what occultists would call the material plane. And most occultists agree that science is a really effective, really accurate way of understanding the material plane. The problem is not that science is wrong, it's that it's incomplete. It's that it takes part of the universe for the whole. In the same way, religion, not religion as a set of ideologies, but religion as a set of practices, as devotion, as prayer, as sacramental worship, these are ways to relate to the spiritual planes. Occultism is the study of what lies in between these two, above the material, below the spiritual. There are all of these realms where strange things happen, things that interact with human beings all the time, but in our culture, we're not supposed to notice that. And so all of these have a proper place. Religion has its proper place. Science has its proper place, but so does occultism. Occultism is the study of the middle realms, the study of the places in between.
In the book, it is mentioned, the path of evolution, different lives, different forms that we manifest in. Mm-hmm. Mineral, plant, animal, human, and humans, spirit and matter balanced. Is that what makes us different from, because I was having a conversation with someone just a few days ago about the difference between animals and humans.
Well, every level in this process is different from every other. I'm sure if you could actually interview a dolphin and a wolf and a tree, you'd find that each of them had a unique experience of the world in the same way, so do human beings. We have, in occult philosophy, we have a particular challenging role. We are at the point where the group spirit, the sort of instinct, the collective drive that keeps animals and plants more or less from running off the rails, that withdraws. Human beings, and probably a few other species as well, dolphins very likely. It's been suggested that all the cetaceans and then elephants and a few other species have reached this point. They don't have that protective guidance of instinct because they've reached the point they need to figure out to be able to function on their own. They need to function as fully individualized beings rather than the sort of partially individualized ones you get a little further down and so on. So, you know, we've reached that midpoint between spirit and matter, and that's kind of our test point. That's the point where we can mess up really badly as individuals, and we can fix things, and we can get the answers wrong, we can get the answers right, we can figure out how to live as individuals in our own direct contact with the divine, and then proceed from there.
I got a lot out of, as I said, I read the book cover to cover, which is not how it's intended to be done, or certainly not in a couple of days. I will go back and explore that in the time scale that it's supposed to be done on. But one thing that came up, apart from the timeline of evolution, manifesting, in different mm-hmm. timelines, what some people would call reincarnation. There was this mm-hmm. phrase that you used, cosmic root substance. And so perhaps you can say something about that, because everything that I've been exploring in terms of trying to understand the reality that we're all part of is always going back to the origin, or even more frustratingly, mm-hmm. the source of the origin. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, the basic occult concept here is that matter as we experience it is one rather peculiar expression of cosmic root substance. There's a basic substance that is common to all things that takes the form of a very dense, inflexible, rigid, condensed form that we call matter. But it also occurs in many other forms. And what we call spirit is simply the other end of the spectrum of cosmic root substance. All things, spirit, mind, matter, are all expressions of this one basic substance. And the usual idea in occultism is that it's a matter of density. When this substance is compacted, it becomes matter. When it expands and diffuses, it passes through mind to become spirit. But all these things are constantly cycling up and down. Everything is part of this one vast process of cosmic root matter.
So do you think that it seems to me, it's certainly in the age that we are living in at the moment, where we spoke about science, you spoke about materialism, that the three-dimensional five-sense reality that appears to us, or certainly that we take to be all that there is, do we just not notice anything beyond that? Or do you think that we're actually taught not to notice anything beyond that?
We're taught not to notice. Many people will remember from childhood being told, stop pretending, stop playing make-believe, that doesn't exist, this doesn't exist, or even, you know, seeing something they're not supposed to see and being punished for it. This happens to a lot of children. Even in common parlance, you hear people, well, of course, back in the day, back in my generation, you would hear people talking about the vibes of a place. Man, the vibes were really heavy at that, you know, in that room. Or, yeah, so, you know, there we were sitting there and this cat came in and wow, the vibes just changed for the better. You can perceive that. That's one of the levels of the vibes, the feeling. That's one of the levels of the unseen. It's something that everybody perceives. Everybody notices when a space feels comfortable or uncomfortable, compressing or expanding, light or dark, however you want to phrase it. These things, people have to be taught to be rigid materialists. And it takes a lot of pressure. It never works for some of us. And so you end up with weirdos like me who end up getting into occultism as teenagers. But it's not natural. Again, the material world is real. It exists. It is part of reality, but it's only one part of reality. There's all the this broader reality, which actually influences it and influences us all the time. And our society, because it has this materialistic dogma in place, enforces and teaches people only to pay attention to matter.
Yeah, well, science isn't nothing. But on the other hand, it isn't everything.
Exactly.
And I think that that's sixth sense, if we want to call it that, or intuition, mm-hmm. or gut feeling, mm-hmm. I say, that we're... It's strange, though, because when I was growing up, a lot of the adults that I was around seemed to, if not rely on that, certainly place a great deal of value on mm-hmm. on intuition and gut sense, on a sort of a knowing that came from what they didn't know where, but they would tell us, it's like, oh well, but you just want to rely on matter of fact, you know, in front of you, you know, as it were, facts. That's how you should navigate life and navigate the world.
But they're not. But they're not actually doing that themselves.
No.
Yeah. No. It's that, you know, and that's typically what you get in a society like this one, a society that has suffered from, I think it was Robert Anton Wilson who used to call it hardening of the orthodoxies, where everything, there's this rigid view of what reality has to be, and everybody gives it lip service, and everyone, you know, teaches it and insists that it's true. But since it doesn't, since such orthodoxies never really work that well, everyone's figuring out ways to, you know, wiggle past it and work around it and make use of the fact that they actually perceive a wider world.
It's interesting that you mention Robert Anton Wilson, because mm-hmm. I've just finished reading your book, Ceremony of the Grail, which we're going to be, listeners, prick up your ears, we're going to be doing a talk about that in the future.
I look forward to that.
But in your book, in that book, you mentioned the phrase Chapel Perilous, and it was Robert Anton Wilson. That's where I first heard that phrase.
Okay.
So I can't remember the context in which he used it, but that was definitely where I first heard it. So.
That's fascinating. I was a little more old-fashioned. I got it out of children's versions of the Grail legend, which is where it originally comes from, and then bad fantasy fiction, of which I read in an endless amount back in my misspent youth. Mm. But yeah, the thing is, Wilson actually he had some interesting things to say about occultism in he and Robert Shea in the Illuminatus trilogy, which was my introduction to Wilson's work. I got that when it was still out there on the bookshelves, fairly new. And one of the things that he talks about, one of the things that he built into that trilogy and some of his other writings, is the idea that the world is more complex than the human mind can really understand. And so we work out these models to try to make sense of it, but the models aren't the reality. The map is not the territory. And so very often people get stuck in these maps, and they have to break out of the map, and they have to, get into the real complexity and sometimes chaotic nature of the world we actually live in. I mean, this is a lot of the whole point of the trilogy.
Now, in the reality, the wider reality, the much, much wider reality that you map out in the book we're talking about, the Cult Philosophy mm-hmm. Workbook, everything that gets labeled, well, positively or negatively as paranormal, supernatural, mm-hmm. all of that stuff suddenly becomes allowed for because of this just much, much wider spectrum, mm-hmm. Whatever way you want to phrase that. So it, all of these things that people are confounded by, it suddenly becomes, it falls in, if you want to use the phrase, it falls within the realms potentially of science. You know,
it's okay. Certainly it falls into the realms of occult study. The whole point of occultism is that we look at these things that the materialists aren't willing to look at. And we say, okay, how do we make sense of this? We do the same thing that scientists do, the same thing that philosophers do, and so on. You know, you gather together your data, and you come up with a model that seems to make sense of it, and you figure out how to test the model. And now the model that occultism has come, I mean, there are many variations, there are many different versions of occult philosophy. This, my book is not, it's not a gospel, it's not a you must believe this. Here is a set of models, try them and see if they work. But it's the one of the standard models within the occult community, within traditional occultism, is that you have seven planes. They're not on top of each other like layers in a layer cake, but that's how you think of them in order to keep them straight mentally with our human mental apparatus. There are these seven planes, and the material plane, the plane of matter and energy, is one of them. But there are six others that are at least as complex, at least as busy as the material plane, and they're all present in the same in every place at every time. Right where you are sitting now, another Robert Anton Wilson reference, you are surrounded by the substance of all seven planes. All seven planes are active right where you are.
One thing that when I was reading occult works, when I first began to dip my finger into this mm-hmm. subject back in the 1980s, and I found mm-hmm. books, mainly Aleister Crowley, mm-hmm. Crowley, I should say. I should learn by now that's how it's actually pronounced. I found the books absolutely impenetrable, but it seemed mm-hmm. to me that it was all somehow about humans and about life on Earth. Mm-hmm. And one thing that the occult philosophy, as set out, for example, in your book, it really speaks to the vastness of cosmic evolution. Mm-hmm. And reading Crowley, I remember thinking that he spoke about planetary bodies, but it was almost like everything off Earth and the wider universe was somehow, I don't know how to put it really, but it wasn't relevant. It was, but it really is. So I recently had a conversation with, I've been reading Olaf Stapledon, and I'd done a mm-hmm. couple of shows about mm-hmm. science fiction mm-hmm. and his vision of evolution and of the vast expanse mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. The potential, shall we say, for mm-hmm. humanity. And
last and first men reaching out into the umpty godzillionth millennium. Oh yeah,
exactly, exactly. So it was even though I knew it already, reading your book reminded me that, you know, that the occult philosophy and the vastness of the known universe, the visible universe, shall mm-hmm. we say, these are intimately intertwined.
Crowley was very focused. Crowley had caught, I mean, I'm not a particular fan of the Not So Great Beast, but I will grant him he was very focused on his specific idea. He saw that magic could be used as a system of self-transformation along the same lines of as many of the Asian paths of, you know, it's like Western Zen, like Western yoga. And he was not interested in worlds and planes and vast amounts of space. He was interested in the transformation of the individual self right here, right now, using the means that he had available. There's a point to that. Unfortunately, because he was so popular, a lot of people lost track of the fact that that occultism can be more than that, that occultism covers and reaches out into a wider universe. And so you have this sort of various post-Crowleyan versions of occultism that are even more focused on individual psychology, basically, and that treat all the rest of the cosmos as if anything, a blank screen on which you can project whatever you want to. The older occult traditions are more useful to my mind in that they recognize that the universe is what it is. There are certain patterns already in place. There are beings, there are powers, there are forces and currents. You can interact with them, and that makes it easier for you to live a successful and human life than if you just assume the universe is there for you, is this blank screen on which you can stick whatever into, you know, on which you can project whatever you want. But so the sense of vastness, the sense of immensities of space and time, that was all over the older occultism. Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, bless her heart, she was, of course, one of the main founders of the Theosophical Society and its main theoretician, author of Isis Unveiled, author of The Secret Doctrine. She really set the fashion for that, writing about, you know, the immense ages of prehistory and vast cosmic systems and so on. In fact, she played a huge role in launching modern fantasy fiction. You know, you don't, if you know her work and you read Robert E. Howard's Conan stories, for example, you'll discover that Conan is you know, swaggering around and fighting and in a universe that's purely theosophical. In fact, Robert E. Howard was not a theosophist, but he used theosophical literature to kind of create the imaginary world in which he put his hero. For that matter, H.P. Lovecraft, Howard's good friend and the creator of all that iconic tentacle fiction, he was a hardcore scientific materialist. He loathed the theosophists, and so there's a lot of parody of occultism worked into the Cthulhu mythos stories. I find that very amusing.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's very interesting.
Oh yeah. Well, that's why I ended up writing a series of tentacle novels myself that kind of stood his cosmology on his head and told things from the point of view of the sinister cultists with the tentacled horrors and all. Theosophy, especially the theosophical version of occultism, especially is all through early 20th century literature. L. Frank Baum, the guy who wrote The Wizard of Oz, he was a theosophist. He was a hardcore theosophist, and which is why Oz is this magical mandala. You have these four kingdoms with four colors in the four directions and the Emerald City at the center. And, you know, and The Wizard of Oz, a group of five, travels from the periphery to the center. And let's see, there's the scarecrow who wants a brain. There's the element of air. We have the Tin Woodman who wants a heart. There's your element of water. There's the cowardly lion who wants courage. There's your element fire. There's Dorothy who just wants to go back to Kansas. I'll say canvas for some reason. Back to Kansas. There's your element of earth. And Toto, the little dog who reveals the wizard behind the curtain. And Toto means, you know, from the one, of the one. This kind of, Toto is the element of spirit. and of course, this is totally deliberate. Mm. And yet nobody notices it nowadays because that kind of occult education is so uncommon these days that, you know, people just go, oh, wow, the Wizard of Oz, neat, and don't even know what the teachings are that are woven into it, what the very interesting philosophical stuff Baum was working with and putting into one of the great children's books.
Well, you mentioned Helena Blavatsky, and one of your recent blog posts was about spoke about Rudolf Steiner. And I don't know why I didn't hear of Steiner at all, you know, growing up, you know, and exploring occultism. It just isn't, it really was the first time I ever heard of Rudolf Steiner. It was when I suddenly found myself in my years as a journalist, stood in the middle of a Waldorf school, and somebody was explaining to us why this was different from a regular school, and they mentioned the name, you know, Rudolf Steiner, and that was like in the 90s. And it was like, well, I haven't heard of this guy before. But I find him to be, certainly he's easier to read than Crowley, but I've been recently listening to a number of lectures and book readings from Steiner, and I find them more easy to absorb when I've been listening to him while falling asleep. And, you know, literally playing them, you know, as I drift off, as it were, and they seem to make more sense.
Oh, no, the thing is, Steiner was, Steiner had the advantage. He had an extremely good education. He was a genius. He was a brilliant, brilliant man, and was a capable philosopher. He did, you know, he graduated with honors from the Vienna Technical University, and he was invited, as well, a very young man, to edit the scientific writings of Goethe for the new standard edition. He was a significant intellectual. Crowley was not. Crowley was a so-so poet, and you know, he had the great disadvantage of the kind of education you got in a very narrow, very rigid and dogmatic fundamentalist Christian sect, which he grew up in. It's no surprise that he revolted against it the way he did. But there were a lot of people in Crowley's generation who never really learned how to write, and who sort of blustered and fuffed and made a lot of noise and piled a lot of words together. Arthur Edward Waite is another great example, very much a creature of the same period, and an even worse writer than Crowley. And I grant Crowley this, Crowley's poetry is so-so, some of it's okay. Arthur Edward Waite's poetry is unspeakably bad. You can find it online these days if you really want an experience in aesthetic horror. But there were a lot of people like that, unfortunately. Steiner was a good writer. Steiner could think clearly. I'm not always sure Crowley could.
That concludes part one of our interview. Part two will be available soon in the subscribers area at legalizefreedom.com.
Legalizefreedom.com.